Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we are going to be discussing the Kunta government of Burkina Faso and the Transition to Democracy program. I am joined by a very special guest, Dr. Mohamed Dan Suleiman. Mohamed is an assistant professor of international relations at King Fahd University of Petroleum and Minerals, and also a research fellow at Curtin University, Australia. Mohamed, it's a pleasure to finally have you join us today. I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you. I look forward to having it too.
Okay. So it's been over a year now. We've seen with events in the Sahel and the coups and the establishment of the new alliance of Sahel states by the military government of Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. But today I wanted us to focus on the transition to democracy. So the president, Ibrahim Traoré, has recently extended the charter, extended the military-led transition to democracy by up to 5 years. So under the previous charter, adopted in October 2022, shortly after the coup that brought Traoré to power, the transition had been due to end by 1st of July 2024, but elections had not been organized. What is the implications of this decision to extend the transitional period?
Well, thank you, Michael. Well, first of all, I think I can start by saying that, this was not unexpected. I find it surprising that people are surprised that their term was extended. The implications can be seen from two perspectives. We can look at it from within Burkina Faso and then from without Burkina Faso. So internally and then externally. Externally, you see that, as you have realized, it will garner a lot of criticism from the international community. Those who oppose the coups to begin with would say that we told you so, that these guys are not here to, bring democracy. They're only here to augment their position and consolidate their stay in power. And so the criticisms will come. But then those who support transition, who support the junta, would, welcome it. On a more substantive level, the implication will be that it gives Burkina Faso some certainty. It gives it more time to renegotiate itself, its relationship with the external environment, be it, the friends of the junta, i.e. actors like Russia and the rest, or its wild friends, but current. For lack of a better word, enemies like France and the United States and other actors. So it gives the country more time to have to negotiate the new relationship that it's got with others. Internally, I think, again, you can look at this whole thing through the lens of the friends enemy binary. You know, if you are in favor of the junta, you would say, I think he needs more time to do what it's got to do, what it promised to do. And definitely the time that it has had so far is not enough for him to solve the problems that the junta promised to solve. Those who do not like the junta will say, these guys are here to, consolidate their power, and we cannot even trust that the 5 years ultimatum will stick. It may be changed as well. Don't forget that it allows, the charter allows Ibrahim Traore to actually contest. You know, it allows him to actually extend it and also contest elections. So the implications are multifaceted, to put it simply. And I guess, you know, going forward, we can, you know, delve a little bit deeper into all those other areas.
Very, very interesting. Very interesting. This is not novel, by the way. It's not novel. We've seen before the third wave of democracy in Africa in the 80s, coming up to the 90s. You see where, let's pick Nigeria, for instance, where you know, we started from the military government of Ibrahim Babangida, and then Abacha. I saw how, you know, they manipulated this transition and, you know, wanted to. So we've seen it happen. We've also seen in recent times in Chad, like you mentioned as well, the charter allows Traore to contest. We've seen in Chad recently where Deby has contested and won. How do you think this is different from the past? Is this still borrowing from the same playbook, or is this current tie different?
Look, I like this question, and that is because I have consistently maintained that this argument that coups are returning to Africa is, to me, very flawed. Okay, I don't think that coups are returning. I think that they never left in the first place. Okay, coups were just hiding behind the facade of democracy. So for me, it is the same old playbook. I don't think much has changed. The only dynamics that I see changed from the past in the current episodes of coups in Africa is because is that previous coups mainly were orchestrated by the Cold War geopolitical environment. And when coups ended, or the number of coups subsided in the continent, or at the time when the third wave of democratization was happening, the Cold War had ended. So the reduction, the incidence of coups was actually a function of the fact that there were less, you know, ideological infighting in the continent. You know, there was no threat of communism to warrant the United States to, orchestrate the removal of a certain president called Nkrumah in Ghana, or for Belgium and the U.S. to connive and rape a certain guy called Patrice Emery Lumumba from the Congo. Okay, so it goes without saying that the moment such external factors come into play, or such other factors come into play that would actually, you know, resuscitate these coup traditions, if you like, the coups were bound to return. Okay, so for me, coups never left. You know, the underlying factors never left. They were only hiding behind a facade of democracy. And the moment the conditions were ripe for them to reappear, they reappeared. Okay. So it's the same governments in the case of Ghana, for example. I mean, who were even lucky? Rawlings left, you know, and then returned. He just felt like he shouldn't have left, you know, and then he returned. So military rulers have a different psychology when it comes to ruling. Okay, they're not usually, because when you come to power through elections, you know that you have 4 years or you have 5 years, because the constitution says so. And if you want to breach it, you have to go through putting an extra effort and do a more convincing, you know, to get that done. But if you're a military ruler, you are not bound by SAS. So the temptation to extend is always there. It's just a matter of cooking up a reason and then extend your stay. And nobody can actually come and really make any noise. In the case of, in this particular case, we can say that the difference, the new dynamics are the fact that you know there is this security threat happening, and the fact that we seem to, you know, the competition globally is the East that is actually, if you like, winning the ideological battle in a sense, and these changes have come after what is very obvious, after consultations with the people, irrespective of whether it is flawed or not. We see that there was that consultation with civil society organizations and core segments of Burkinabe society. Okay, mm-hmm. So that is there. And the fact that we see that the people actually seem to be supporting these changes. So generally, on a more substantive level, I think it has come from the same playbook, but the nuances have some, you know, differences here and there.
Very interesting. Very interesting that you mentioned the politics of the Cold War and how it in a way sustained military rule. And when there was a clear winner, you know, there was less appetite or support for that. That was what, yeah. You know, if you say from what, from, and I agree with you, that led to that clawback rather than, you know, wholesome change towards democracy. So it was a forced democratization. In my place, I've looked at it as a militarized democracy anyways. It's just, you know, just changing military gap for whatever, but the whole philosophy, militarization still remains. But you mentioned something quite interesting as well, that I think, again, there's a continuum. So if I use your friend's enemy binary, and are we seeing a second Cold War? Where now we can't talk about Clinton, but as it stands now, like Riley said, it seems the East is winning. So are we seeing a second Cold War? Is that second Cold War fueling this, and will it help to consolidate these authoritarian or coup powers in Africa?
Yeah.
Is that what we're seeing?
Yes, I think, you know, the question can be flipped. You know, we can flip it on its head and say, are we having a church scramble, for example? Yeah. You know, it's happening. It's happening. It doesn't have the same ideological intensity as the, you know, original Cold War. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have the same ideological intensity as, you know, the second scramble, for example. But it does come with certain level of novelty. For example, we are in an age where the youth are massively informed, like they have the information, they can see government, unlike before when the youth, you know, there was no internet, you know, the youth had to, you can only rely on what they see on TV, right? But now they can actually see government, they can feel government, they can hear government, they can touch government because of technology. So it has those new dynamics. All right, but I think yes, there is a new Cold War in a sense that there is definitely a war happening. There is massive conflict happening. It gives, if you like, the Eastern actors the opportunity to exact their pound of flesh against the West, you know, in these parts of Africa. But like I said, it lacks that ideological and strategic intensity like the first. Like the first one. Same for the second, this so-called third scramble. You know, China and Russia, the United States and its allies, everyone is competing, you know. But again, and not just that, I think these actors see Africa, I mean, as you probably agree, to be very key to the future of not just the world, but their own, the future of their own positions on the world stage. You know, talking about the youth, the population of Africa, the projections, the youth, the resources. You know, I read somewhere that about 35% of global mineral resources, you know, natural resources are here in African continent, you know, and I'm told that less than 5% of that has been explored. Okay, so you can see how the continent, apart from its human resources, you know, the actual, the natural resources are actually going to shape the future. So they all see the continent as being instrumental to the future, and makes it it makes the competition intense, because living in a multipolar world has, if you like, leveled the playing ground. So it becomes very difficult for it. The competition is complex, if you like. So these are the dynamics. So I definitely think there is a test scramble. There's a Cold War, but without the intensity, there's more liberalized, you know, there's more trust in institutions, at least on the international stage. The UN has been there for over 70 years, unlike the initial Cold War when the UN was just a baby. All right. Yeah. So we see these changes are there. But yes, there is a war happening. There is a battle happening in Africa at the moment.
I agree with you. I think, again, to buttress what you're saying, unlike the Cold War, where Africa was not necessarily the battleground, it was more like Africans, they didn't have cast proses. You know, but right now it seems Africa is playing a major role in terms of like a physical battleground. I agree with that. But I'll come back to all of this theoretical side of it. Let me go back to what you said about the popular support. Because no matter how authoritarian a government is, no matter how we've seen, you know, empires have been brought down by the sheer determination or resistance from the people. It carries force. It's very rare, but when it does happen, it carries force. So like they say again, when a government is brutal and ruthless, there must be some element of support from you know, the demographic, the, you know, the citizen, the population. So whether this is informed or whether they are being manipulated, you know, whether they come from same ethnic group or based on identity base, we know that people support this, you know, governments with that. But in Burkina Faso, as well as in other places like Niger and all of that, we've seen where the citizens have come out, you know, anti-French narrative and all of that. Like Rivali said, there seems to be that. Do you think this is one that is going to be sustained? Do you think it's one that is rightly informed? Because again, I would agree that there is a sense of validity. It's legitimate. Let's not undermine the legitimacy of the grievance of the people against, you know, the traditional conventional partners. So, but how do you see this support in terms of medium and long term? Do you think it can be sustained? Do you think there's going to be a crack? Especially amidst the economic holes and insecurity that still persist.
It's a very interesting question. And we can look at it from a number of perspectives. First, we cannot expect the military government, the government of Ibrahim Traoré, to behave and survive in an environment different from what other governments in Burkina Faso have survived in. You know, we know the nature of state-society relations across African countries. We know that usually governments enjoy a certain level of legitimacy in the first few years in power, and then subsequent years, you know, it's a free fall. Like they lose legitimacy, like something. You get it. So if that has been the nature of governments across the continent and in parts of in these countries, you don't expect this government to all of a sudden operate in a whole different an environment. Okay. So let us assess governments on the basis of what we know is the nature of African societies, state society relations, African countries. Okay. So I would not be surprised really if 2 years from now, Ibrahim Traoré becomes so unpopular that there's another coup. Okay. But what matters is that now he has the support. And I like the fact that we should not belittle the legitimacy, because The protests we see in the streets, okay, and the screens, no one has come out to tell us that they are not true, they are false, they are adopted. They are actual real Burkinabes who are in support of their leader. I think it will be condescending for us to think that it is staged. You know, because that would be us taking away the agency of the Burkinabe people. They have the right as citizens of their own country to support whoever they want. You know, so that is a very important point. The other point is, we come to talk about even this conception of democracy itself. That conception of democracy itself. But here, I believe that for now, if Ibrahim Traoré loses support going forward, it will not be surprising for me, because that has been the very DNA of state-society relations in Africa. And much more so because of the challenges that Burkina Faso is facing now. You know, terrorism incidents and attacks have increased, you know, in the last few months. You know, economic crisis has always been a problem in the community, in the country, and following the sanctions and following the pressure and all of that, these countries, not just Burkina Faso, but the other Sahel trio, all of them are going to have to go through some hard times in terms of the running of their countries. Okay, so for me, the trick for Traoré and his friends in the region may be to the extent that they are able to, you know, their way out, their success for me would depend on how they are able to pursue a politics or a policy of pain for gain, if you like, you know, convincing the people that, look, these are hard times, okay? Give us time, but also, you know, tighten your belts, you know, for hard times, and then eventually things will get better. But without that, the people are going to get fed up eventually, and they are going to feel the pain of all these restrictions, and all the transition, you know, comes with a lot of difficult moments. And that's going to dip, you know, the trust and the confidence the people have in Traoré and the level of the legitimacy of his government. And my point is, that is entirely normal, because we cannot expect Burkina Faso to be unlike what it has always been.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Speaking of another coup or challenge to this, we've had, there have been, I don't know if these are rumors or if these are genuine, there have been attempts at to overthrow, if we can use that word, Ibrahim Traoré. There have been, like, I've heard, like, up to three attempts to that, been cracking the military. There's also been a case where they say some soldiers have been killed or whatever. Well, are these true? And how significant is this to the survival of the junta government?
Yes, nothing has come to me to suggest that these are not true. So at this point, these are credible information that we have. And he has indeed survived attempted coups. And again, just like the change, the extension of his stay in power, this is also not surprising. He is very popular at home, but very unpopular in certain quarters in the international system. And when you ask the question about a new Cold War, this was exactly where my mind went. I never got to make that point. This is coming from the playbook of the Cold War, where there is a coup and then there is a counter coup and all of that, all being orchestrated from without. And it is not surprising, because you cannot say that Burkina Faso's military is a homogenous whole. It's a homogenous entity, with all of them coming from the same ethnic or cultural demography of the country. So Ibrahim Traoré will have enemies, will have people who oppose are to him. There will still be people, men in the military who are affiliated with Blaise Compaoré, for example. You know, there will be people who are affiliated with the man he overthrew, and those who are affiliated with the one he overthrew, right? So there are a lot of actors in the military, and these people will not be happy because it is power. This is the currency of politics, power. And whoever has the power has to protect it because he or she knows that there are others who want that power. Okay. So I will not be surprised if there is another coup attempt. In fact, I will not be surprised if he is actually removed going forward. Like I said, Africa has become a much more important actor in the global political arena, you know, and given how important the Sahel region is to Western actors, and here I'm not making any moral judgment here. I'm not saying it is right or wrong. I'm only saying how states behave. You know, if my country, Ghana, this tiny country, were to find itself in the space where France, for example, finds itself now, I would make the same argument. Because states will always look after their interests. Okay. Mm. If the Sahel is so important to these countries, then they will find ways, you know, to regain leverage. Because when the West loses, it is the East that wins. Mm. And when the East wins, it is Russia and China, you know, that wins. And so it becomes really clear if you look at this whole thing from the very, very lowest level of the international system all the way up, because they are all connected. You got it. They are all connected. So yes, I would not be surprised if there is another coup. Okay. Just that it will be messy. I think that when they say another coup, it will trigger a civil war. That's what I think. In Burkina Faso, because of the support that he has.
It does boil down again to the political system. And like what is so, if you look at it from independence in Africa, with Africa's tinkered with you mentioned Nkrumah, the you know, when you were talking, tinker with one Pan-African, one party system, they tinker with parliamentary system of government, they've done this, and then you did question the concept of democracy, which I have done in my work as well. I've looked at what is democracy or liberal democracy. Can liberal democracy be the whole fanfare we have over elections and in Africa, is are we making the right choice? Is that even the way out? Are we practicing the right thing? Because when we talk about democracy, we usually just see as electoral democracy, liberal democracy, and all of that. And then we want to question other kind of systems of government in Africa. So moving forward, do you think all of this is boiling down to the need for a homegrown kind of system? I don't know what to call it, but because I think democracy shouldn't be associated with just a specific demographic or Western, Westphalian kind of like democracy. Do you think that is a problem? Because whatever you see, it's like you rightly mentioned, state-society relations in Africa, whether under democracy, whether under military, have not yielded a dividend to the people. So do you think this is a crisis of that kind of political system in Africa? Is it bigger than all of what we're talking about?
It's way bigger. It is way bigger. And that is why we should not see what is happening in Niger or Burkina Faso or Mali independent of each other, removed. They are not removed from each other. It is Mali is as connected to Burkina Faso as Niger is to Gabon, for example, and Guinea and others. I think democracy is in crisis. Liberal democracy, I should qualify, it is in crisis, and that qualification is extremely important, because sometimes we think that democracy is liberal democracy and vice versa. No. Before liberal democracy, if you go to you're a political scientist yourself, you go to the very basic definition of democracy, it's government of the people. It's as simple as that. And when the people are actually making the decisions and they're the ones calling the shots, then that's democracy. The election of the issue of elections and protests, they are only acts that are associated with democracy, but it doesn't guarantee democracy itself. Those acts don't guarantee democracy itself. You could have elections and elect a leader who will be everything but democratic. You know, so liberal democracy is in crisis. It's biting the dust, you know, all around, you know, the continent. And I believe that these coups are reminders that the democracy we are practicing is faulty, and we need to rethink that democracy. You know, it doesn't make sense to many people that we hold elections on empty stomachs, for example. It doesn't make sense that, you know, our leaders only speak a language that they themselves understand, and the people do not understand. You know, it doesn't make sense that a country like Niger would dedicate huge sums of money to print ballot boxes to elect a few people who will come in and then benefit their own families and friends and forget about the people. You know, it doesn't make sense that when you elect a leader, the moment they are elected, they forget about you. They only come back to the people when it is time for elections. You know, in my mind, this is how I see government in Africa. I mean, this is not tested, but I have observed things with a Ghanaian example and even Nigerian example. Usually, a country that has 4 years of four-year term, for example, the first year, governments used to blame the previous government. That's what they do. Second year, they begin to, you know, share the booty, like they appoint their own people in government. Third year, because fourth year is election, they begin to pretend as if they are governing. And then fourth year is election year. So nothing to be done, you know, and the cycle goes on like that. Yes. So that is a problem with our democracy. And the solution to me is to go back to this argument that our scholars and some of our leaders have made over the years. You know, democracy itself is not a bad thing, but how we practice this is. How we practice democracy is. And if we are able to not celebrate the means, but the end, because that's what we celebrate. We celebrate the means, like elections and protests and demonstrations and all of that. The end, irrespective of how ugly the end is, as long as the means are fine, you know, we are okay. You know, so it is time for us to rethink. And in my mind, how to rethink is to bring back the agency of the African into the center of politics. Let this democracy speak the language of the people. Let that democracy respect the cultural norms and mores of the people. Let the democracy let the people reflect, see their reflection. When they look at democracy, they should see themselves in the democracy. For now, the democratic dispensation is too white because it is too European. You know, and it ostracizes, it disenfranchises a lot of Africans and a lot of African citizens. And until that, you know, suffrage is returned to them at the level of quality and not quantity, then we can hope that there will be no more coups, and that there will be stability, and that we will not have a lot of jihadist groups. You know, there will not be crisis of nationhood, because people will belong, because people will see the essence and the use of their states. Right now, the state is useless. So if someone is going to hijack the state, you have a lot of support, because the state has a lot of enemies, even within its own territory.
I agree with you 100%. And democracy itself is not only in crisis in Africa. It's even in the Western Hemisphere.
A very important point. Sorry for cutting you. A very important point. Yeah. Now, if you make this argument that you've just made, I just made, people say no. It is too early to cry the failure of democracy. Okay, let us give ourselves time. And then I ask myself, like you said, even democracy is in crisis at source. Okay, if it is in crisis at source, what hope do we have here in Africa? What is the guarantee that 150 years from now, our democracy will mature enough to prevent the instability that we're going through? You get my point? Yeah. Anyway, sorry for cutting. You can go ahead.
I agree with you. And in the last couple of years, I've been working on, matter of fact, I submitted a book, was that's going to do, you know, in the light of the Sahel crisis, democracy and militarization, following up on my recent book on militarized democracy in Nigeria. And they were doing, I'm currently editing a special issue on that, democracy and militarization, where, you know, sometimes you're talking, but you don't know that others share the same sentiments that they are sharing in terms of what kind of democracy is being practiced and how we need to start evaluating and look at that. But let me bring it back home before, you know, we wrap this up. So we've been seeing, whilst a lot of people are saying, oh, this trio, like you called them, Burkina Faso, Mali, cannot survive. And then, you know, there's every reason to believe they can't. You know, they're landlocked states and, you know, they need. But then again, we see them with the first summit in July 6th. They've come to sign this first summit to integrate their defense and all of that. And then on the next day, you see the ECOWAS, nursing hope that they'll come back. And, you know, you see the empty seat in Abuja with the summit for Mali. And they didn't. Do you think... What do you think? Do you think this is still like a game of gaining leverage? You mentioned something like, is it a game of the gaining leverage? Do you think the alliance of Sahel states is here to stay? Do you think there's prospect of them being integrated into the ECOWAS states? How do you think this dynamic is going to play out?
First, recently, a former general, actually, with a lot of experience in West Africa, you know, part of ECOMOG, you know, and other military missions, asked me a question, whether I wanted the Alliance of Sahel States to succeed. That was the question.
He wanted, I think I know what you're talking about.
he wanted my opinion on whether I wanted the Alliance to succeed. And I found myself conflicted because if I said yes, then it would sound like I am wholeheartedly legitimizing coups, all right? But then if I said no, I felt like I was undermining the agency and the legitimacy of the citizens of the Sahel, Alliance, right? So for me, your question, it can be answered from different angles. First of all, we should not think that they cannot survive. In fact, they can, okay? They can, and they can survive, and survive very well. Usually, we find people saying that these countries are landlocked, and, you know, they will need Ghana, they will need Benin, they will need Togo, you know, Ivory Coast, to have access to the sea. Okay? Yes. But Ghana, for example, also relies on Burkina Faso for onion, you know? And I've been told, unconfirmed, but I've been told that even before the sanctions, or ECOWAS removed its sanctions, Ghana had already opened its borders to Burkina Faso, okay, to get in, to get the onion, because the Northern Association, those who import onion, were feeling the pinch of the sanctions. So they put pressure on the government, and they gave them access. I don't know, you know, I can't say this is true, because that is the information that I have received. Whether it is true or not, what it tells is that we also, these countries, Ghana also relies on Burkina Faso. It is the relationship is not unidirectional, okay? It goes two ways. All right. Secondly, there's a dynamic that we forget, Michael, and which is the fact that Morocco and Algeria are arch enemies, okay, in that part of Africa. And they will be competing for leverage in the Alliance of Sahel States. Okay, you see that Algeria once wanted to mediate, you know, the crisis. At some point, Morocco has actually opened its arms, you know, to these countries. So what these countries may lose by not having friends in Ghana, they may gain by having friends in Morocco or Algeria. Okay, and with We also tend to forget that despite the fact that America, the United States, is the world's foremost superpower, militarily at least, Russia is also a force to reckon with. Okay? China is rising, if it has not already risen, okay, to take everything. All right. And these countries are just business-minded. They just want profit. And this is the resources that are there within this alliance of Sahel state countries. It can give them anything. Okay? So, the short answer to, I guess, your question is, they can survive, okay, but without difficulties. Okay? As to whether they will return to ECOWAS, yes and no. Yes, if ECOWAS plays its cards very well. I do not think that making for Nyazimbe of Togo and Bashir of Senegal the guys to go and talk to them, it helps. I actually find that to be very condescending, because these guys are relatively younger. Where are the senior leaders of ECOWAS? Why can't Tinubu, for example, President Tinubu of Nigeria, swallow his pride, you know, and go to these guys and say, look, we aired, which if I think ECOWAS actually aired to begin with, because you don't the way they dealt with the crisis is very undiplomatic. It was very un-ECOWAS, if there's any such thing, you know, and that actually worsened everything. So why can't they send these guys there to talk to them? You send a very young person, you know, to them. It's like they are young, so you are younger, go there, talk to them. No. You know, so if they play their cards very well, they can come back. You know, they can, you know, bring down the statutes of the Alliance of Sahel States, the Sahel Confederacy, and make it some kind of pact, and still come back to ECOWAS and still do whatever they're doing with their own alliance without necessarily disintegrating it, right? But if ECOWAS continues to take that unreasonable, you know, undiplomatic stance, you know, and if AU actually also does the same, then it will continue to consolidate, you know, the power of these Sahel countries. It will continue to give them legitimacy, because they can go to their people and say, this is how they're treating us. And when there are problems, they can tell the people that your problems are because of ECOWAS. So just be patient with us. It will give them more legitimacy, and it will give them more power to, you know, just be daring enough, you know, just be daring and consolidate there. So it will depend on the actions of ECOWAS. I believe everything will come back to the actions of ECOWAS and even the African Union to a certain extent.
I was going to ask the very last question, but I think you've kind of covered it. But I think let's wrap up by looking at since we've talked about ECOWAS and the dynamics, let's talk about the friends, and let's end up with the friends and enemy binary, like Russia and all of that. How do you think their support will play out in the long term in this place? What do you see? What do you see moving forward in terms of like the West-East dichotomy and how it relates to this place? Let's wrap up with that.
Yes, I think, well, the audacity of these Sahel countries comes in part from the support that they've received from actors like Russia. You know, because for you to kick out, you know, a traditional partner like France, and ask the U.S. to take its troops away and prevent, you know, limit the presence of the U.N., the European Union, and these other actors, you must have an option, okay? And so on this score, Russia has been a key factor in the successes, you know, and the courage of these countries to do what they have done. So going forward, this is why, you know, because the success of these countries and the Sahel Alliance will not come from home alone. It would have to take into consideration the resources at their disposal, you know, the makeup of these countries, the support they have at home. But importantly, remember the state in Africa only is surviving through mimicry. It doesn't survive on the count of empirical sovereignty. It only survives largely because of juridical sovereignty, because other countries say it is a state, because the UN says it is a state. So once it has that juridical international sovereignty, it can survive. And now these countries can hope of having at least two veto-wielding powers supporting them. Mm-hmm. You know, so they can survive. For Western countries, I think the US and France, what they would do, initially when the France was kicked out, I thought that they would practice diplomacy, a proxy diplomacy, you know, by using their ally, the US, to do what they have always been doing. And then the US started becoming too unpopular within the region. And now they are also slowly being chased out. Now, so what will happen, I think, is that there are other allies that could step in for these countries and still manage to get something. The Western countries will consolidate their presence in countries like Ghana, you know, and offset whatever they might have lost by their removal from, by their departure from these Sahel countries. So they will do that. But it can also fall on allies, you know, like Australia, you know, and Canada, you know, and other, you know, European countries to actually be present in that regard. But I believe, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, if I were to make a judgment on the success, the potential success of the Alliance of Sahel States, I would say they have about 6 to 7, you know, chance of actually succeeding because of several other other factors. For the Western countries to come back in, I believe that they should try as much as possible to now make ECOWAS, get ECOWAS to do the needful, which is operate diplomatically. And they should make efforts. They should go to these people with respect. I think the condescension from both ECOWAS and the Western actors have actually gone a long way to make this crisis, to sticking this crisis too far. The crisis has brought things that shouldn't have brought because of the way the Western actors saw the situation. Let me finish by saying that whatever that happens going forward, it has to be, the onus is on me and on you and on any other person to make sure that the region is stable, because the region is a very, very important region of the world. When something happens in the Sahel, it doesn't only affect Africa, it affects the world because it sits at the corridor of Europe, you know, and it has direct link to even South America, you know, we may not realize. So we should advocate for stability and true democracy. That only true democracy that can guarantee that stability. There's no point taking sides in this because it will only worsen the conflict. What matters is we need to take a very, very balanced and, you know, if normative position, but has to be balanced in our analysis of it to make sure that the region actually sustains itself in peace and stability. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the impact is not going to be on Burkina Faso alone. It will be on the entire region and indeed the entire world.
Wow. Thank you very much, Mohammed. This is very deep and insightful. And like you rightly said, you know, the failure of it's not just for the Burkina Faso people or for any of these countries, it's for everyone. It's going to be felt by everyone. The sources or whatever of the region as well is to the benefit of everyone. So, you know, we try as much as possible to present balance and objectivity. And that's why we do things like this, to bring experts like that and we discuss the situations and see how we could help those that listen, policymakers, whatever, to be able to see, you know, take a clear picture of the situation and how to proceed. I'm really grateful. I think it's worth the wait, Mohammed.
Yes.
We should have had this episode a couple of, if not a month ago or more. But it's worth the wait. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your insights. I really, really, you know, appreciate. And once this is out, once it's about to air, I will let you know, and then you could share it among your network as well. For now, sure. Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me, Ben, Michael.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for tuning in once again to today's episode. And join me as usual to thank Dr. Mohammed Dan-Suleiman for his very useful and insightful knowledge and views on the transition program, transition to democracy program in Burkina Faso, and, you know, wider conversations around the Sahel and the true government, the alliance of the Sahel states. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you in the next episode.